You're all very kind. You know, Mr. Lippincott, I wondered, though, when you said that the Central Committee was nonpartisan until after the election, you meant after the primary election,
didn't
you?
That's what I meant, Ron. I'm sorry.
I mean, there's a limit. Let's not carry the sportsmanship too far.
I meant that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is it's wonderful of you to be out here tonight. I, of course, was a little disappointed when the governor wasn't here. I read where he had hastened back from his vacation in Greece. Actually, I think the reason he came back so soon is there's a limit to how long he can allow the office empty with Jesse Unruh still in town. This is a wonderful world, this world of politics. You know, George Murphy told me after his last campaign, he said that when he was campaigning, some wonderful things happened to him. He said a sweet little old lady came up to him one day and took his hand in both of hers. And she smiled and she said, "Oh, I remember you when you were George Murphy." And then she said, "I think your speech was simply superfluous." And George tried to top her. He smiled and he said, "Well, thank you, ma'am. I'm thinking of having it published posthumously." And she topped him. She said, "I can hardly wait." But it is a wonderful world. Not too long ago, I was in Washington. And it was a cold spring evening, and I was walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, and there was the White House all lighted up now that the election's over. He has to leave it lighted up. It's the only way he can see to read those Republican campaign speeches and find out what to do next in Vietnam. But you know, seriously, I was so happy tonight, and the beautiful music and singing that we heard, that other verse was included. I think perhaps today, when we have so many things made legal that are not quite moral, that sometimes all that's left to us in the way of protest is to reassert our belief that this nation is under God by singing the verse that reminds us. And I'm so happy these young people could be here, because perhaps there aren't enough adults today that are daring to recognize the fact that no nation has ever lasted very long when it once decided to stray away from its religion and its belief in a God. I have some quotes in the remarks I'm going to make tonight from a French philosopher, Alexis de Tocqueville, who lived and visited this country some 100 years ago. I'm going to even add to them, because I can't help but think, having heard this beautiful music tonight, that in addition to the things I'm going to quote from this great philosopher, he had something else to say about America when he visited this country. He was interested in the great experiment going on and what accounted for our greatness even then, 100 years ago. And in going back to France, he wrote, "I searched for the secret of America's greatness in her busy cities and her harbors teeming with commerce, and it was not there." He said, "I looked in her mines and in her broad fields and looked on the commerce under rivers, and it wasn't there." He said, "Not until I went into the churches of America did I understand the secret of her greatness. I heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness, and I knew then America is great because she is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great." Also, 100 years ago, an Englishman, Lord Macaulay, wrote not so approvingly of our experiment. He wrote a letter to an American friend. And he told this American friend that in the 5th century AD, Rome was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns. He said in the mid-20th century, and that's approximately the period we're in now, he said, "Your republic will be plundered. But with this difference, Rome's barbarians came from without her borders. Yours will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions." And then, to quote him again, de Tocqueville, probably this was what Macaulay had in mind, de Tocqueville said, "The end of freedom comes when the party in power learns it can perpetuate itself through taxation." Well, what does happen to freedom when the executive branch can use the money taken from the people in order to coerce the people? In the book The Law by Bastiat, he said, "The state is the great fictitious entity by which everyone seeks to live at the expense of everyone else." And you wonder, are we fearing something that perhaps can't happen? And then we realize that there was hardly any mention in the press when not too long ago the Congress of the United States was approving the poverty program, and Representative Glenn Andrews offered an amendment. Think of this. He offered an amendment that you would think was completely unnecessary. The amendment would prohibit poverty funds from being used for political purposes. And the Congress of the United States overwhelmingly voted down this amendment. 4.5 years ago, we were told, "Let us begin." And more recently in a campaign, "Let's get moving." Well, we began at the new frontier, and now we're face to face with the great society. Along the way, we've added $30 billion to our debt, but we've decreased our gold holdings to the point that there is concern felt for the solvency of our currency. And soon the coins we jingle in our pocket won't be composed of silver, but will be of base metal and just symbols and promises. We've discovered that every family with less than a $3,000 a year income is poverty-stricken, but each family's share of the tax burden in the nation, the expense of government, federal, state, and local, is $3,300. The farmers' net income has dropped, but their debt in relation to income has reached an all-time high, even higher than it was on the eve of the 1929 crash. $2.86 the farmer owes for every dollar of income he has coming in. The crime rate is up 30%. So is the rate of business failure. And 4.5 years ago, there were no daily casualty lists, no wives and mothers receiving telegrams that began, "We regret to inform you." In the last campaign, don't we all remember how our opponents presented themselves as actually conservatives? They were the conservatives in the sense that there would be no great upheaval, no change if they were returned to office. They would maintain the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. We, on the other hand, were presented as radicals who'd bring about some cataclysmic upheaval if by some chance we were put into office. Well, now the wraps are off the great society, and a multitude of messages have made it plain that we're to have the welfare state with an unprecedented federalization of American life. We're spending $10 million a day more than we were spending just 1 year ago, $260 million a day. The numbers have gotten so big they don't stagger us anymore. It's almost impossible for us to realize the enormity of this kind of spending. And on June 30th, in spite of all of this, Congress hiked the debt limit for the fifth time in 4 years. Here in California, we've just been handed the biggest budget of all of the 50 states and the biggest budget in our nation's history for any state, $4 billion. We were told it was a bare bones budget. Well, we know whose bones are bare. 2 years ago, when it was $3.25 billion, the governor called it austerity. Last year, at $3.75 billion, it was frugal. It took California 100 years to reach a billion-dollar budget, and only 9 years to double that, and only 5 years to double that. And you wonder if we're supposed to try for 8. Among the top 10 industrial states, California is number one in the combined state and local taxes. $420 for every man, woman, and child in this state. And we're told that all this is due to the increase of population. Well, no one denies that as the population increases, the workload, the need for public service increases proportionately. But during the period when we have doubled our population, our state expenditures have increased 10 times over. And since this administration took office in 1939, our income, yours and mine, has increased an average of 11%. But personal income tax collections have skyrocketed 143%. Property tax has gone up 41%. Personal exemptions have been reduced. The franchise tax on business has been increased. And emergencies are met not by tax reform, not by some sensible permanent policy, but by one-time tax windfalls, such as last year eliminating the installment collection on personal income and corporate income taxes. And now, faced with another deficit, In this moment, the stopgap is to step up the collection of sales taxes. Government is like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. But because of our willingness to accept our responsibility for those less fortunate, welfare has offered government its greatest opportunity for growth. Now, there's serious discussion given by learned men in our government, granted to the idea not only of helping those in need, but of actually divorcing the need for work from income, with a central authority satisfying not only the needs of the people, but the people's wants. To quote that same Frenchman de Tocqueville again, he warned that such a government would cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform. Thus, the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided until the nation is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals of which government is the shepherd. Well, can anyone deny that our limited government, with its decentralized powers, has given way to planners? And these planners have laid an increasingly heavy hand in every facet of our lives. The president's fond of quoting from 1 Isaiah, the 18th verse, "Come, let us reason together." Now that has a sort of a cozy, inviting sound, doesn't it? Come, let us reason together. But uncomfortably, let your eyes stray down to the next verse or two. There's a line he doesn't quote aloud. "If ye refuse, ye shall be devoured with the sword." Freedom is very fragile. We've only known a few moments of it in all man's history, and most of those moments have been ours. But freedom is also indivisible. There is no S in freedom, no S on the end of it. You can't elect to be partly free, to give up some freedoms in exchange for security and hang on to other freedoms. Either you're free or you're not free. There is no dividing. Now, there are some among us whose concern for all who lack the material benefits prompt them to sacrifice without restraint the rights and the freedom that were guaranteed by the Constitutions. Indeed, many of these people have voiced their idea that the Constitution itself is outmoded and should be declared outmoded in the interest of providing security. Now, I don't challenge their right to be heard. As long as they're honest, as long as they don't lead others to believe that we can have both the great society and our inalienable rights. If we ever decide we need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we'll keep one sentence from the old. "He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance." Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. And in the case of California, that's not easy. We've added 50,000 employees in just the last few years. Did you ever stop to think that it only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 people in this country to keep us well and healthy? But it takes 130 federal employees to manage and administer the affairs of the national government. Government-owned corporations compete with privately owned business, and in so doing, they've lost $81 billion, more than a fourth of the national debt. The average businessman has 2,700 government forms to fill out each year. It's estimated it takes 35% of a businessman's time just to fill out government paperwork. And it's also estimated it costs American industry, and this is added into the price tag that you and I pay, $20 billion a year to handle this paper. And then you and I, to add insult to injury, are taxed an additional $7 billion to pay for the government's end of handling all this paperwork. Some years ago, to show you how this can happen, Freeport, Maine, joined with a lot of other communities, perhaps your own, in the distribution of the federal surplus food for needy citizens. It seemed a logical thing to do. If we could produce a great surplus of food rather than waste it, why not use it, distribute it to the needy people who couldn't afford to buy it? But they were increasingly smothered under a load of federally demanded audits and reports and other paperwork, until Freeport, Maine woke up one day to discover that they had enlarged their city staff so much just to handle this paperwork for the free federal food that it actually was cheaper to give up the free federal food and just buy the groceries for the needy citizens in the local grocery stores. so they've withdrawn from the program. Now, of course, undaunted, government declares war on poverty. Now, I'm sure all of you remember that when they passed the poverty program, in all the debate that preceded it, one state was mentioned over and over again, West Virginia. This became the synonym for poverty and distress and unemployment. You'd think that we were passing the poverty program just to cure the problems of West Virginia. So the bill is passed, and now we discover West Virginia is going to get $400,000. Texas is going to get $10 million. This is just a coincidence, I'm sure. Maybe they need a little target practice to identify the enemy. Gum Springs, Virginia was just handed a grant of $74,000. Believe it or not, $54,000 for administrator salaries and $20,000 for the poor. The mayor of Paterson, New Jersey's pretty upset. He's just discovered that the federal poverty administrator in his town's getting $1,000 a year more than he as mayor gets. Well, maybe West Virginia was lucky. 2 years ago, the Area Redevelopment Agency decided to help them out. They decided in one area that West Virginia needed a furniture factory. So they put up $2 million. This factory was going to provide 100 jobs. And then they poured in another $1 million of federal aid. They persuaded the West Virginia Industrial Development Authority to add $134,000. The local banks chipped in $75,000. And the local citizens invested out of their savings $220,000 additional dollars. Well, the factory is closed. There are no jobs. There were no profits. You see, somebody neglected to find out whether there was any market for the furniture they were going to make. No one would disagree, I'm sure, with the humanitarian goal of the youth portion of this program, to salvage, if possible, those young men and women in our country who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet the responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. In L.A., they've taken over a 13-story hotel to salvage some of the young women in this program. And they're spending $7,000 a year for each young lady they're going to help. There are a lot of American families raising fine, productive citizens on incomes of less than $7,000 a year. A congressman just shocked his fellow congressman, Congressman Okonski of Wisconsin, telling an incident involving two boys from his district. They're brothers. One of them in uniform in Vietnam is getting $78 a month to defend his country. His brother, a dropout, arrested for beating their mother, is getting $200 a month under the poverty program for pushing a power mower. The plain truth is, granted we should salvage these young people, but by what rhyme or reason or common sense do we pay these people we're salvaging more money than your sons will get when they don the uniform to go out in defense of their country? I'm sure that all of us are agreed in the moral responsibility to provide shelter for those who, through no fault of their own, lack adequate housing. But now a bill has been passed to subsidize rent, and it's actually possible under this program for people with incomes in excess of $10,000 a year to qualify and have their neighbors chip in out of their tax funds to pay their subsidy so they can live in a neighborhood and a home beyond their means. Our traditional laws of eminent domain recognize the occasional need for government to take private property upon payment of a fair price and upon proof that there is a clear and present need in the public interest for this particular piece of property. But each citizen who owned that property had his day in court, and the government had to prove there was a clear and present need. Well, now a variety of programs have diluted public interest so that it's anything a few of the planners decide it should be. Urban Renewal was created in 1949 to quickly provide decent homes for every American and eliminate slums. No one quarrels with that purpose. But in a 10-year period, Urban Renewal has destroyed 126,000 low housing or low rent housing units. It's replaced them with a scant 28,000 at a higher rent. It's left almost 1 million displaced persons to find shelter at higher rents and create new slums. Meantime, in that same 10-year period, by contrast, the private building industry has built 27 million dwelling units. Now, the law says the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But if standard housing at rents they could afford in convenient locations had been available before urban renewal came into existence, they wouldn't have had to have a bulldozer to move them out. The people would have gone there already. Robert Weaver, the Federal Housing Commissioner, has stated that the government gave the people control of the land in the beginning of this nation to speed its development, ignoring, of course, the fact that the people were here first and had the land, and the people created the government. Now, Mr. Weaver says, the policy of the federal government is going to be to reclaim complete control of the use of the land. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over our farms. They survey from the air to see if there are violations of the crop planting allotments. Every dollar that we spend today on price, or that we were spending on price stabilization in the agricultural program in 1948, today we're spending $25. And yet, what result? Well, today the farmer's getting 37 cents from the market basket dollar, the lowest proportion he has ever received in history. 2 million farmers have moved to the city in search of jobs, and we're told that 2.5 million more should go. Last year, farm expenditures were up $200 million, but farm income dropped $200 million. With one voice, government tells us that the small farm is uneconomic, must go, that only the large farm can satisfy our needs for the future. But the same government, with another voice, insists on maintaining the 160-acre limit size on irrigated farms. Over here in the Imperial Valley, we have just seen our government violate a signed contract with the farmers there who for 30-odd years have not been subject to the 160-acre limitation, and now the government says the contract doesn't count. By January 1st, reduce your farms to the size of 160 acres. And no voice is raised in Sacramento in behalf of the citizens of California, just as no voice was raised with regard to that ridiculous decision that canceled the Bracero program. Unfortunately, when Washington sneezes, the Gesundheit is heard in Sacramento. Secretary of Labor Wirtz finally condescended to come to California to stalk through our fields, and he turned out to be something less than a jolly green giant. But he said that he'd solve all our crop picking problems and our harvesting problems with schoolboys during the summer vacation. But in a few weeks, the school bell rings. And in a few weeks, California reaches its peak need, with some 400,000 workers needed for the harvest. Now the government says, after to the governor, after saying that George Murphy was wrong during the last campaign, he's changed his tune, and he says the secretary's doing a difficult job. He says it's different from what our Department of Employment thinks should be done, but he could be right. I think he's wrong, but he could be right. Now, there is the ringing voice of leadership. Now the dominoes begin to fall into place. Food prices reach an all-time high. California produces 70% of the tomatoes for all of the canned tomatoes in the United States, 70% of them. But they've reduced the plantings by one-third in California because they knew they wouldn't be able to harvest them. The loss to California farmers already is in excess of $20 million in this single crop. The loss to labor is felt in canning companies, some of them with the biggest and best-known trademarks, moving to Mexico. Meanwhile, the network of rules grows more minute. You know, down in the Mason-Dixon line, on a highway that's used by tourists who are vacationing in the South, there's an oil station. And a very enterprising fellow runs this oil station. There's a little triangle of ground between the driveway and the sidewalk. Now, a lot of oil stations faced with that, they cover it with gravel. This fellow, being in the position he was in, planted some cotton bushes there. And he figured when the northern tourists came by and stopped for gas, he gave them a little premium, a little present, a souvenir. Picked a cotton bowl from a cotton bush, probably the first many of the tourists had ever seen, and presented it to them as a souvenir of their trip to the South. The federal government has just fined him for planting cotton without an allotment. Are we safe in our books and our records? We've just discovered that the post office has been taking mail, letters addressed to American citizens who happen to be back or delinquent in their taxes, and turning these letters over to the Internal Revenue Service. We hear tales of spying and one-way mirrors and bugging of conference rooms where clients and lawyers can be listened into with the tax collectors. Almost every county in California finds welfare taking more than a half of its total budget. Not so long ago, Tulare County announced that welfare spending at the end of the first 9 months was more than double the total amount that had been budgeted for the year. Now, most of this is because of regulations forced on the states by the federal government and in turn by the states on the local counties, so that there's no chance for the local administrators at the county level to put into effect sensible rules and practices, even though they can see the need for them. Do we think that it's no longer proper to teach the simple virtues, reward for labor, or to repay when we borrow? In California, there's a small college town up north of here. The local Rotary Club for some time has had, as a civic project, the maintenance of a loan fund. They raise money, and they lend this money to needy students in this small college. No interest, and the students don't have to pay the money back until after they graduate and are out earning a living. The other day, the dean of the college called the Rotary Club and said, if you're not willing to make this an outright gift, we won't need it anymore because the federal government's putting up the money now and the students don't have to pay it back. Now the states find themselves creating culture bureaus because Washington's going to subsidize art and literature. Two czars is the idea in Washington, and they'll grant millions of dollars on a basis of their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art and literature. Now, perhaps I'm unduly disturbed by this, but if they follow the pattern of government-sponsored scientific research, there's reason for some concern. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a scientist, and I don't pose as such. But sometimes I wonder if the government isn't subsidizing plain intellectual curiosity when I find tens of thousands of dollars being spent on a program of research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only phrase there that I understand is that part, in the middle. There I know who they're talking about. And now the nation's capital concerns itself with recreational facilities and our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great out of doors. They've got a new booklet. It's by the Special Engineering Services Branch of Environmental Engineering and Food Production of the United States Public Health Service. That's not the book. That's the agency that puts it out. It's 134 pages of profundities, and you wonder how we managed to get along without it up till now. For example, get this. If you lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such height that the drinking level is convenient for the persons using the fountain. Wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. Insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. Well, I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But this isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that by ourselves. Inflation planned and deliberate on the part of the federal government, supposedly as a stimulant to our economy, has reduced the spending power of the dollar, the value of the dollar in the last 30 years, to 35 and a half cents. In the last 20 years alone, it's eroded the value of our savings and our insurance policies by $190 billion. I can remember when I was a boy, my father used to say the country needed a good 5 cent cigar. What this country needs is a good 5 cent nickel. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the productive free economy than any society has ever done without ruin. And the government practices bookkeeping tricks which would jail a private citizen. You and I have been told that we're going to have a $5 billion cut in the excise tax. At the same time, we're told that the deficit is only $3.5 billion. But on the same day they announced that, the Treasury Department announced in the Daily in the Nation's Press that the debt had gone up $7 billion. Maybe figures don't lie, but maybe someone lies about figures. And at the state level, all the bills go up because of this federally created inflation. Wearily, at the state and the local level, we look around for new sources of revenue. But when we suggest tax reform, it turns out to be the old shell game. Just rearrange it and apply it somewhere else while we try to convince every citizen that we're robbing Peter to pay Paul under the pretense that Peter is loaded. Well, let's take another look. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul, and you and I are all named Paul. Peter went bankrupt a long time ago. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can reduce taxes without reducing the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. Now, in an atmosphere of emergency and an excessive zeal for our welfare, the federal government proposes to invade an area that has been the traditional province of the local and community and the state, the finest public school system the world has ever known. At the same time, they deny that any federal control is intended. They deny every suggestion for solving any financial problems we might have at the local level by tax credits for educational costs or remitting tax revenues to the states or the communities for use without any federal strings attached. The truth is, competent authorities in the field of education have testified before congressional committees that there are no problems that cannot be met in the educational field that can't be met at the local and state level. We've built $30 billion worth of classrooms in the last 10 years. We've reduced the ratio of pupils to classroom and pupil to teacher. We've increased the average teacher's salary by 65%. We've increased at the local level school revenues by 156%. Last year, the American voters approved the largest school bond issue in the history of the nation. And nevertheless, there are 135 separate offices and agencies already in the federal government, doling out money to colleges. At the opposite end of the spectrum now, the poverty program will begin with kindergarten. Of the two, I'm a lot happier to have the government involved in finger-painting and playing in the sandbox than I have at the higher level of education. When a group of college professors, alarmed at the threat to academic freedom, went to Washington and suggested a program whereby you and I could deduct from our income tax and contribute to the colleges to solve their needs, without the money being routed through Washington. Over and over again, they kept asking the authorities in Washington, why won't this plan work? And finally, a Freudian slip occurred. Francis Keppel, the United States Director of Education, said, you don't understand. Under your program, we couldn't achieve our social objectives. Social objectives. Well, if the government's going to build the schools and buy the books and grant scholarships and make judgments and exert pressures, what if one day that pressure is of a political nature not to our liking? Education is the bulwark of freedom, but you remove it too far from the local community and too far from the parents' control, and education becomes the tool of tyranny. 100 years ago, we faced the problem of a nation half slave and half free, and whether such a nation could survive. Today, we face a world that's half slave and half free. And the problem today is whether mankind itself can survive. We call out to the guard in the night, does all go well? And echoing back from the shores of the Potomac comes the answer, there's nothing to fear. Nothing to fear. We face an evil enemy who, since World War II, has increased the enslavement from 8% of the world's population to almost 40%. Every lesson of history tells us that as a nation has grown in culture and refinement, it has softened. And when it's confronted by the less cultured, the less refined, the barbarians always triumph. You and I have come to our moment of destiny. We can't meet the problems of a divided world or a divided nation with a splintered party. I speak now to Republicans. If there are Democrats present, and I was one myself for a great deal of my life, I would like to suggest that the problems I've mentioned, the problems of freedom, cross all party lines. There's no longer any room for just party loyalty because of a label that you've grown up or grown old with. Today we have to look at what is happening to the traditional structure of our nation. But because of the nature of this rally tonight and this meeting, let me direct my words now to Republicans, because we are the ones faced with the challenge. For too long we've been Republicans with descriptive adjectives and hyphens. Liberal Republicans, moderate Republicans, conservative Republicans, any manner of descriptive adjective. The plain truth of the matter is we've been sucker Republicans. Our opponents gave us those adjectives and those hyphens, and it's high time we bundled them up and gave them back. It's high time that we started just being Republicans. And if we have to use a hyphen, If we have to use a hyphen at all, let's just be Republican Republicans. We can cringe in the shadow of a philosophy we fear and detest, but fear to challenge, or we can rise from this defeat and begin the second round of our struggle to restore the Republic. Let's be a party of opposition. Opposition to the misguided leadership at home and opposition to all the evil abroad that threatens the dignity and freedom of man in every land. Now, we can't do this by trying to outpromise our opponents. They've got a monopoly on that. To those in our midst who talk cynically of voter blocks and of political expedience to attract them, let me suggest that there is a voter block, a voter block that crosses party lines, racial, religious, and ethnic lines. It's made up of unsung heroes, made up of Americans who get up in the morning, who send their kids to school and who go to work, pay their bills, contribute to their church, their charities, and their community. They believe they were created in God's image and that God is the author of all their rights and freedom, and they're disturbed because their children can no longer ask God's blessing on lunch in the school cafeteria. Well, that block of voters can be ours for the asking. If you and I, as Republicans, are willing to stand on principle, if we're willing to tell that block of voters that we believe that the problems of poverty and old age and disease can be solved, but that we want to solve them without resorting to unnecessary compulsion and fiscal irresponsibility, that we too believe we can put a floor beneath which no American will be asked to live in degradation, but at the same time, we shall unhesitatingly repudiate the idea of erecting a ceiling above which no American can rise without being penalized for his energy and his initiative. Let us tell that block of voters that we won't buy our protection from the threat of the bomb by trading away the freedoms of people in other lands not ours to give. Let's tell that block of voters that if their sons are going to be asked to give their lives someplace in the world for their country, at the same time they can die knowing they've had the right to try for victory. Thomas Wolfe said, "To every man his chance, to every man regardless of his birth his shining golden opportunity, to every man the right to live, to work, to be himself, and to become whatever his manhood and his vision can combine to make him. That is the promise of America." An earlier generation of Americans pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to give us that promise and our freedom. And many Americans since have died to keep that promise intact. We pray devoutly, as I'm sure those earlier Americans prayed, that we shan't be asked to make such a sacrifice. But one thing is certain. Unless we're willing to make that same pledge and make it aloud within the hearing of the enemy, then freedom will be lost in our lifetime. And our failure to meet our challenge will be recorded in a book yet to be written called The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. The pathway of history is littered with the bones of dead empires. If we're to follow, we'll have no decades or centuries for leisurely decay, because the enemy at our gates is combat lean and hard and hungry for everything we've created. We and we alone in this moment of time must make a decision as to whether freedom will perish from the earth. I think it's time for every Republican, because today it is our party that is the vehicle behind which all people, or upon which all people, can ride and return us to the constitutional form of government that we have known for 200 years. It's up to us then, as Republicans in charge of that vehicle, to look deep in our own hearts, to ask ourselves, in these times of division and split that we've known in our party, whether we, any of us, can possibly have any difference with any other republic that is more important than this responsibility that faces us in this day of need. If we do feel that there's some difference, some grudge we hold, some feud or some split in the party that's more important than the challenge to freedom, then I think you and I should be prepared to tell our children and our children's children someday what it was we found more important than freedom, because I'm sure they'll want to know. Thank you very much.
Ronald Reagan, thank you very much for this inspiring speech. We're very proud to have you tonight. We're very proud to have you as a Californian, as a Republican, and as an American, and we wish you well. I have been asked to remind you that the snack bar is still open, and I would imagine there are a few dollars and cents to be collected, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, this goes to the TARS. So on this beautiful evening, when this meeting adjourns here in a few moments, may I suggest that you retire to the snack bar, which is right behind you on the other side, and let's spend a few shekels and sort of cool off a bit and have a little fellowship. I'm sure that you all have been inspired by our address tonight by Ronald Reagan, and we hope that we have him back again. We appreciate his coming here tonight and helping us in our endeavor, and as I said before, we wish him well. Again, may I thank the Chaffee College group here for having us tonight, and especially Dr. Daniel B. Mulligan, the president, and the college staff. We are indeed indebted to them and thank them very, very much. May I thank the committee again for the wonderful job that they have done for us.